Okay, good afternoon. Today, Cabinet has decided to extend the deployment of the New Zealand SAS Task Force in Kabul for a further 12 months from April, but with about half the number of personnel. The deployment will be a much smaller contingent of approximately 35 personnel. This compares to approximately 70 deployed now. The focus of the SAS will continue to be primarily on partnering with the Afghan Crisis Response Unit and ensuring that the work that they've been carrying out to bring that unit up to a high operational standard is completed. This is the main reason for the extension of the deployment. As is currently the case, New Zealand will continue to retain full command of this deployment. In making this decision, I've been assured by the Chief of Defence Force that any Rugby World Cup commitments will not be compromised by a smaller contingent continuing to be based in Afghanistan. I cannot comment much further in terms of specifics of the current deployment, but as has been the case in the past, the government will comment from time to time on SAS operations when it's in the public interest to do so. I'd like to add that in terms of the wider New Zealand deployment to Afghanistan, which includes the provincial reconstruction team, decisions on the future of this will be made in the next few months. To the latest from Cairo now, you'll appreciate that this is a very fluid situation, but we know that 299 New Zealanders are registered with the MFAT as being in Egypt. The New Zealand Embassy in Cairo is working with a small number of people who have indicated that they wish to leave the city. MFAT's best advice is that there are 120 New Zealanders in Egypt who are contemplating leaving, although 66 have said they will not leave until they really have to. Of the others, 7 are at the airport and have confirmed flights out, 34 are waiting at home, 12 tourists are looking to leave in the next few days, and there is one person who has been contacted to find out, one other person who is struggling to find out what they want to do. Another 60 New Zealanders have already left Cairo. This information is based on those New Zealanders the embassy has been able to contact. We are encouraging all New Zealanders in Egypt to contact the embassy as soon as they can. Also, if they are in contact with friends travelling in Egypt, you should be giving them the same advice. In terms of facilitating New Zealanders' exit from Egypt, there are a number of options available to us to take people out of Cairo, including commercial flights, chartering an aircraft or sending a military aircraft. Most countries have decided that the commercial option is the best one at this stage. We are actively working with Air New Zealand and a number of airlines and have blocked bookings in place for those who wish to fly out. We've also spoken to Air New Zealand about chartering an aircraft, and that option is available to us if required. In the event that commercial flights are no longer available, we have the Air Force 757 available if required. New Zealand is closely coordinating with Australia, the UK and Canada around evacuation planning. MFAT continues to advise against travel to Egypt due to the extreme risk to security. MFAT will be giving media another update at 5 p.m. and will continue to provide regular updates as long as the situation continues. Tomorrow there is a one-day caucus at Premier House. We expect to discuss the year ahead and the economic outlook. Ministers will provide updates to caucus on key policy issues, including education, welfare, infrastructure and law and order. The one-day caucus will begin at 9:30 tomorrow morning, and I will talk to the media during the lunch break. In terms of the week ahead, I'm in Wellington till Wednesday, then Auckland on Thursday, where I'll speak to the Manukau Grey Power and also attend a Crime Stoppers function. I'll head to Waitangi on Saturday morning, where I intend to follow my usual program. On the Sunday evening, I'll attend the Governor General's Waitangi event at Government House in Auckland. The House resumes for the year next Tuesday, when I will give a statement to Parliament outlining government's plans for the year. The debate that follows is a 15-hour one and will occupy much of the House's first week of the year. Well, the best information I have at the moment, yes, this is likely to be the last rotation, and the reason for that is that the extension came at the request of the SAS themselves, who believe that they have, for the most part, completed the job, but would like to see just a further 12 months of work with the Crisis Response Unit to be fully satisfied that they have all of the operational capability that's required. Now, obviously these things are fluid, but that's the best information we have at the moment. Sorry? They could do, but I think they are the best people to assess that, and I've personally spoken to the head of the unit on a number of occasions, and that's their assessment at the moment. Well, they think that the crisis response unit under their leadership, if you like, over the last 12 months or so has made tremendous progress, and they've worked alongside them, partnered with them on a number of missions. I think tremendous work's been carried out in Kabul. We can't detail every operation that they've been on, but I think it's fair to say that the praise that is heaped on the SAS from our partners around the world and from others is fully justified from the information that I have. So I can appreciate their desire to stay a bit longer, and I think that shrunk down unit is probably the appropriate setting for the next 12 months.
You could argue that the military would always want to stay on longer.
Yeah.
What's the principal reason that you would want
to stay on? Well, I think the decision that we made to deploy the SAS was the right decision. 18 months ago, I believe that New Zealand should be playing its part to ensure that we can stabilise the situation in Afghanistan and ultimately provide a safer environment, and one that doesn't deliver the breeding ground for terrorism that we've seen in the past. And there's no question that New Zealand SAS forces in the last 18 months, partnering with the Crisis Response Unit, have undertaken many missions which have delivered that safer environment. So my view is the original reason for deploying them was right. You're right that, of course, you know, those kind of people might want to stay longer, and that's one factor that we had in the mix. But I think their assessment is right, that if we can make sure the Crisis Response Unit are fully equipped to deal with the situation, then they provide a long-term solution to Afghanistan, and it's our intention to bring the SAS back after that 12 months. So there'll be 2 6-month rotations. I don't think ISAF actually made a specific request. They've certainly, constantly recognising the contribution the SAS have made, and they would like, obviously, as many people as we can. But in terms of a formal request, I don't think they put that in terms of numbers. I mean, the minister's been over from time to time. They've certainly expressed, the significant contribution they're making.
Could we end up in a position where the SAS may stay in Afghanistan longer than the PRC?
I think that's unlikely. Cabinet needs to discuss that issue about the PRT, and we'll be doing that within the next few months. As I said before, we know that Bamiyan is right at the top of the list in terms of handing over control fully to the Afghan people, but even then, there will almost certainly be people as part of that provincial reconstruction team there for quite a long period of time. It's a question of how many people we have and how rapid that phase out can be. Cool, I can go.
Okay, sorry.
Yes. I haven't read the report. I intend to do so. There are one or two things which would be unacceptable to the government. We have no intention and plans to raise GST. We don't want to bring additional taxes on stream, because we don't believe that would be in the best interest. Clearly it's a very complex issue. I mean, whatever we do has to lift national savings. So if we're simply just raising private sector savings at the cost of reducing public sector savings, then the net position is square. But I think they've identified correctly in the summary that I've had, the need to grow national savings by 2-3% is correct, and we'll need to go away now and flesh out which options are the best ones and which ones are affordable and under what timetable.
In your speech, you seem to speak positively about the idea of making some changes to the inflation index or do some other measures along those lines to encourage savings. Do you still think that's the case?
Yeah, look, the point I was making was that there are some disincentives and some anomalies in the system at the moment in terms of what tax rates apply. So certain PIE rates are far more generous than other savings vehicles that people use. Now, what hasn't been fleshed out in the report, as I understand it, although I haven't read it, is the cost of rectifying those anomalies, and that's something the government will need to go away and work on. We are cash-strapped. We don't have a lot of room to move, but clearly we want to lift national savings. So.
Thank you.
And the recommendation to introduce a lower interest rate on student loans. Would the government be open to that?
That's not our intention at this point. I haven't seen that recommendation, but it's not our intention to put interest on student loans. That's one. Well, my understanding is that they haven't recommended compulsory, but they've recommended a system of getting more people to enrol, hoping that inertia will keep more of them in the program, and if that doesn't work, then considering compulsory. I mean, there are merits for and against, but you know, one has to say, I think that it's been a success that 1.5 million New Zealanders have a KiwiSaver account, and if more of them had them, then I think that would be a good thing.
Could there be a way, presumably, of doing it without it actually costing anything as a mechanism, without it, you know, costing the government at all?
Well, unfortunately, there are costs. I mean, firstly, if we continue with the $1,000, then that's the initial cost. But also, of course, the matching contribution that comes from the government is costing us around about $1.1 billion, I think, at the moment. And that would obviously rise if there were more KiwiSaver accounts.
Are you saying that there'll be no extra money doing Harry savings in the budget? Are you trying to keep it absolutely cost neutral?
No, I'm not saying there's no money. I'm saying that we have very limited scope to move. The reality is we're going to reduce our new operating expenditure to about $800 to $900 million. Now, that doesn't mean that we won't find larger savings than that $200 to $300 million and redeploy some of that in other areas. And depending on the cost and the timing, that is a genuine option for us.
So what's your overall assessment of the
state of
working group? Is it useful or
reformable? Well, it's my personal view, they've identified absolutely the right issue, which is New Zealand's level of foreign indebtedness is unsustainable and makes us vulnerable as a nation. I think New Zealanders having a diversified saving portfolio and an increased level of saving gives them higher levels of security and comfort and more options in their future. We'll know that on average we'll live longer. So the merits of those that objective are unquestionable. The question is just simply whether we can achieve that change.
So you're criticised for putting too much emphasis on the government's ability to save, given that the government's share of national debt is actually only on a smaller portion as opposed to the private sector. Do you think the emphasis was right or wrong?
Well, I haven't read the report to look at that, but I mean, it's a statement of fact that private sector debt is considerably larger than public sector debt, although that's rising. That's one of the reasons why the government is keen to get back into surplus quicker than we had initially indicated, because that is the area where we have direct control. And the challenge, of course, is putting in place incentives to get the private sector to save, but in a way which doesn't substantially reduce public sector savings itself, and that's the issue, of course.
What's the main concern? Public debt or private debt? The Treasury released figures yesterday which said private debt's actually come down over the past 18 months.
It has, and that reflects New Zealanders' perspective that we need to be conservative at the moment, and I think that's why they will ultimately reject the plans that the Labor opposition are proposing, and that is to spend, borrow and hope. That is not what New Zealanders have been doing in the last 18 months. They've recognised the difficult international position that they're in. So if you go back between about the 2004 and 2008 period, I think the saving rate was about $1.15 for every dollar they earned. In other words, I think they consumed about $10 billion worth of additional debt. In the last 18 months, they've been saving in the order of, I think it's $6 to $7 billion, that sort of magnitude. So they've certainly switched around. It's the total level of indebtedness and the amount of that debt that's borrowed from foreigners that is the issue. And that is the reason why Spain, who have a very similar profile to New Zealand, are in the gun from the rating agencies. So it's not, you can't just say it's one or the other, it's a combination of both.
But Treasury says, and those figures seem to suggest that our total level of net debt has actually reduced from 90% of GDP in March
to 85.
To about 85% it has. Now. So we're trending better, what's the threat from the credit agencies?
Yeah, well, so the threat is, A, 85% is extremely high. Secondly, we borrow most of that debt from foreigners. So no other OECD country borrows as much of its debt as a proportion of its overall indebtedness from foreigners. So that puts us in a very weak position. And as we saw with Standard & Poor's, when they downgraded Japan on Friday. So this stuff is real. And in Japan's case, virtually all of its debt is funded from domestic savings in Japan. So having that high level of external indebtedness is a worry. If you look at New Zealand's total external liabilities, I mean, they've been sitting in that sort of 70 to 90% window for quite a long period of time now. So the long-term objective has to be that New Zealanders fund more of their own investment, if you like, through higher levels of savings. Government, that's 200% of GDP, but the private sector savings are very high. There's an inflection point that they go through, I think, in about 2012-13, where eventually they'll have to start borrowing from the international markets, and that will put quite a lot of stress on the Japanese economy.
So what's changed from November last year when Standard & Poor's credit watch came in and you were reasonably confident that we weren't at risk of a credit downgrade? What's happened between then and now that makes the credit downgrade?
Well, what happened, you've got to remember, right up until the point that they put us on negative outlook, what they were actually saying to us was they were overall comfortable with the government's debt and reasonably comfortable with the position that New Zealand was in, notwithstanding that they have for quite some time outlined that the overall level of indebtedness is very high and the reliance on foreign borrowings. What happened was that we saw a flare-up in the international markets again, and the credit spread started blowing out in countries like Spain. So that position led the rating agencies to put us on negative outlook. And the message from them is quite clear. If we don't get that position under control in the next 2 years, they'll downgrade us.
So these are a few take on these recommendations from the savings working group. You're saying they don't have to be fiscally neutral if you can find savings elsewhere?
Well, effectively, they need to be fiscally neutral because we're wanting to reduce our level of new budget spending from 1.1 billion to 800 million. What I'm saying is we might find a greater level of savings and redeploy some of those savings to fund those initiatives that we want to do.
Why couldn't you do that with the tax
working group? Well, it's the same thing. That's exactly the point. The tax working group.
Well, the tax working group had to find ways in their recommendations that this one would even out that one.
That's right.
The government wouldn't have to find...
Well, they didn't have to. They came up with a set of recommendations. The tax working group said, look, there are a number of problems with the tax system. One was around the integrity of the system, the differential between the top rate and the trust rate. The second thing was the over-reliance on corporate earnings and the fact that they believed there was greater capacity to iron out the integrity issues in the system by raising GST and lowering personal taxes. We happen to agree with that analysis, but net on net over a four-year period, it was fiscally neutral. In the case of the tax working group, the savings working group, as I say, I haven't read the report, but my understanding is they haven't actually quantified the cost of making changes to the to fund savings initiatives, so I can't tell you, and they can't tell you at the moment what those cost. I mean, one would assume they're quite expensive, but we'll need to go away and look at that.
Prime Minister, a question on ECE. Favouring the Minister of Moroni's release and correspondence today between the Minister of Education and the Assistant Chancellor, Margaret Hinger.
Yep.
In it, the advice from the Minister is that you may wish to consider an optional charge for a 20-hour ECE responding to her outlets. Financial problems. Labor says that's a breach of the election promise to keep 20 hours ECE free.
Well, I haven't seen the correspondence, and I'm always, with very good reason, very suspect about the way correspondence from my ministers is characterised by the Labor Party. But there is no breach of the 23 hours. That is available. Nor have most of the claims made by Labor been accurate. In fact, last year we spent $1.4 billion, or this year $1.4 billion on ECE. Last year we spent $1.2 billion. We're not putting less into ECE, we're putting in more. But in terms of a centre, their options are quite clear. If they are under 80% teacher-led, there should be no change to their funding. If they are above 80% teacher-led, then they can reduce to being 80% teacher-led and there should be no impact for their clients. Or if they want to stay above 80% teacher-led, they could absorb that cost themselves. If they don't want to do that, obviously they have the option to pass that on. It's a free market.
So the phrase written by the Minister, and I haven't copied the letter yet, you may wish to consider an optional charge for 20 hours ECE. That's not a breach of the promise.
No. You're not going to throw that orange at me, are you?
No.
Okay.
Can I ask, why didn't you decide to put on a plane in Egypt?
Why haven't we?
Yeah.
Because at the moment, we're comfortable that the options we have available to us through commercial exit points for New Zealanders are adequate. So, for instance, we know some New Zealanders got out today. We've block booked flights on a number of airlines tomorrow. and they'll be available to New Zealanders. We've spoken to the Australians and the Canadians who have got commercial charters. They have much bigger numbers at Egypt looking to leave than we do, and subject to the number of their nationals that take up those seats, any spare capacity would be offered to us as well. So as you can see with Australia, I mean, they have chartered a plane, but it's still not going to get there till Wednesday, so it's not a quicker option than the ones available to us. Now, no one can rule out that the commercial options evaporate. That's always a possibility, and if that was the case, then we'd have to use military capability. But very few countries are using military capability at the moment. The earliest it would be able to get there would be Friday, but there are options for military capability that are already in the region, not ours, military planes, but we have partners who might lend us those assets if we need them. It's in New Zealand, and its next deployment is actually down to Antarctica for the Erebus flights, but you know, we have the capability of deploying there if required. Yes, I understand the CDF made those calls today. I haven't spoken to them. I spoke to them first thing this morning. I haven't spoken to them this afternoon. But that's certainly an option available to us. Well, I guess we'd take a Herc or maybe a C-17, depending on what they did. But, I mean, at the moment, the way we've looked at it is that there are people that want to leave. We accept that. There are commercial options for getting them out. And that looks to us to be the fastest way of them getting out of Cairo. If that fails to be the case, then obviously other options are available to us, but they will take time.
It's interesting to talk about the fastest way, because Murray McKelly said today that there were 30 people in Cairo who wanted to get out urgently yesterday, or last night, in time, I think.
Yep.
And four got out today,
correct,
were bumped off flights, presumably because Britain's protecting its own citizens by letting them on their own flights first. So why can't you either divert a plane from London, a New Zealand plane, to Cairo?
We could divert a plane, but I think you'd have to say, well, I think given the environment that's there at the moment, that's the most logical way to go, is to use the commercial capability that's there. Now,
the most logical one, the fastest.
Well, it's potentially both. I mean, to divert a plane, we could take a plane out of either Heathrow or Hong Kong, put it into Egypt, but at the moment there are relatively small numbers that would want to go. Now, those numbers could increase, and that will obviously depend on, you know, there's a very large protest tonight. There are some people, for instance, as I said, I think looking at the numbers, 34 or whatever, that are hunkered down in their home or the place that they're staying, who don't necessarily want to go to the airport immediately. This isn't a situation where commercial options aren't available. I mean, obviously it's a stressful situation in Egypt, and some people will definitely want to get out, and that's why we've secured the block bookings for them, so that option is available.
What's your assessment of the level of danger New Zealand is in Egypt face? Is there real present danger, or is it just general unrest?
Well, again, at the moment, and this can obviously change, but the advice we've had is that the protests are not actively engaging foreigners that are there. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't get caught up in the protests or caught up in unruly behaviour, but for the most part they're not actively seeking out foreign tourists and inflicting violence upon them. And for that reason, I think that's why quite a lot of people are just simply staying put where they are. They're safe and feel comfortable in the environment they're in.
Given the groundswell opinion that seems to be against President Mubarak, should he step down?
Well, look, ultimately, that is a matter for the people of Egypt, and I'm sure tonight we're going to see a very large protest which would signify the feeling at least of those potentially million people that they are proposing will go out in the protest. I mean, from New Zealand's point of view, like other countries, we've simply said that if there is to be a transition, then we'd want a smooth and peaceful transition to take place. You know, Egypt is an important country. It's provided stability in the Middle East, and we'd obviously want them to continue to play that role, but it's for the Egyptian people to determine who their leadership should be.
Has Mubarak been a positive force in the region?
I can't comment on everything he's done, but you'd have to say that in terms of providing stability and a way forward with Israel, then yes, they have. And they're a large, significant country where for 30 years now there's been, you know, a peaceful solution. So in that regard, I think yes.
In terms of more recent action, they seem to have shut down the internet completely now. Does that seem like an appropriate level of response to
you? Probably not, but as I say, I've seen some unusual behaviour recently.
Prime Minister, on UFB, what's the state of play with the regulatory package that Telecom in particular is waiting to see?
Yeah, I can't comment specifically because you appreciate the commercial aspects of that. The Minister and, well, more importantly, Crown Fibre Holdings are continuing to hold those negotiations, and as we've made clear, Telecom is potentially a significant partner, so we just need to leave that to run its due course.
So
the
Cabinet see nothing at this stage on that?
Not specifically in relation to Telecom, but it has had, you know, continues to have discussions about that overall package and the progress that's been made, both in terms of rural and urban fibre.
Was the minimum wage discussed
today? No, but most likely next week. Okay, thanks very much.